Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Dinosaurs. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of The Natural Selection Presents. This week's theme is dinosaurs. But I suppose you should meet the team. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hello.
And I am also Nick. Hello. You guys doing all right?
It's another week, another podcast, dinosaurs. What else? What's good? I mean, that's what's happening. It's great. What else could you want?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Two very different responses there to the same question. Nick, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
I would love to, Nick. We're the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Every week we gather and wax lyrical about the natural world and the wonderful things in it. In the first section of our delightful podcast, we talk about the news and interesting things related to nature in the newspapers this week. In the second section of our podcast, we talk about a different theme and how it relates to the flora and fauna of the world. This week's theme is dinosaurs.
Thanks, Nick. Have you guys had any interesting nature interactions this week?
I saw a cormorant today, actually. It was cool.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Do you know what, living when I lived in England, that would have really excited me, but they're like 10 a penny here.
Can't wait, really?
For cormorants. Yeah, they are. There are loads of them here. I see them all the time.
Well, I was quite excited. I don't get to see them that often here. So, I did also see some ducks and geese. I got given out to the last day for not mentioning, even though they're there. And there was also some swans and cygnets. So, and then pigeons and crows. But, you know, that's the...
I had, finally, I've had this interaction before. It's also a bird. But in Tempelhoferfeld here in Berlin, it's an enormous airfield that's been converted into a public park. And there's a huge section of it that's cordoned off. And it's just right now filled with tall grass as a bird sanctuary. And I didn't know what birds were living in it, but I see them every time I visit. And they sort of do this hovering thing in the wind where the wind comes through the field and they like stay in the same spot and flap their wings quickly, but they stay like a pencil point in the air. But it's a Eurasian skylark. I didn't know. But apparently they're super dense in that area. But I saw some yesterday.
I have read that there is a rather healthy population of birds of prey and like hawks in Tempelhof. Which I suppose makes sense because if you think of a perfect environment to hunt like little rodents, you would think a wide open field with like nothing to hide under. And it's an old airport. So that's literally what it is.
It is. It's one of those places where you walk into it and you can see the end. You can see the far end when you walk in. But if you walk towards that far end, it does not get closer. It takes a long time to walk across the Tempelhoferfeld. Good place for birds.
Cool. Well, on that note, we should probably get on with the news. Naomi, I think you wanted to start us off in the sea.
I did. So this piece of research, it was made by researchers working out of the University of Exeter and a couple of other places, but also the Center for Whale Research. And this piece of work was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and it was looking at social interactions in a group of killer whales. So what this piece of work did was it used drones and was able to observe their interactions using drone footage. And what it found was that there was kind of a homophily is what the paper called it, but basically that the whales tended to have more social interactions with other whales that were either the same gender or the same age or both. And also they found that female whales and younger whales tended to be more in the center of all of these social interactions, and then males and older whales tended to be kind of further out of the social interactions. And what was also interesting about what they found was that it's kind of different to research that they've done before, because other research was using associations instead of actual interactions. And so based on associations, they were finding that there wasn't actually these age and sex influences. It was just to do with relatedness. But now when they're looking at these other types of interactions. So, you know, surfacing at the same time or touching each other or interacting with each other in that way. They find that actually there are is this kind of age and sex influence, which is much more similar to other mammals and other dolphins, which kind of makes sense. But it shows that, you know, looking at things, it's important to kind of look at things the whole picture, and that some proxies don't necessarily work. They don't tell us the whole picture. So that was a piece of research that I had this week.
Cool, yeah. Sort of shows the importance of, yeah, seeing the whole picture. Which, yeah, I suppose, yeah, with modern technology, it gets easier and easier. Weirdly, my topic is unexpectedly related to yours, and this is something they've just discovered. Researchers in China were looking at soft-furred tree mice, which is from the genus Typhlomys. What they think they found is an example of echolocation, which is previously only seen in the toothed whales. Things like dolphins and orcas also are into that sort of carrion, and bats, obviously. But this is evidence for the first rodent that does echolocation. And they found evidence in all four species, I believe. And there was some interesting evidence for it. So firstly, they found that they were actually emitting regular ultrasonic vocalizations, with the highest frequency being 98 kilohertz. And when they were put in a cluttered environment, sort of like a almost like a maze, I imagine, they would vocalize these at a much higher rate, which was interesting evidence. But also, there was evidence in their body types. So they actually shared ear morphology with other echolocating animals, which was more evidence that this was perhaps happening. And when they looked within their genes, they found that their hearing-related genes actually matched up quite nicely with other echolocating mammals. So it appears they have the genetic framework, they have the ear morphology, and they have the behavioral evidence that they're doing echolocation. So, yeah, a nice example of an echolocating rodent for you. But, yeah, and Nick, I believe you wanted to talk about something that was once long forgotten.
Yeah, I wanted also to talk about something in the sea, sea lacanth. So we've talked about these, thanks. We've talked about these before on this podcast, I think a couple of times. They're pretty cool. They're what was once known and sort of falling out of fashion, this terminology, but as a living fossil. They're the only surviving species in a lineage that branched or that diverged from other things a long time ago, and all the other related species have gone extinct. They were thought to have gone extinct millions of years ago until they were found in the 1930s alive, and basically from deep sea fishing that one of them was found. And it was like a big shock to the fish fossil community because suddenly there's this species that exists that really hasn't changed much since dozens of millions of years ago. And seems like at that time it was sort of a big surprise. It's been an interesting thing to study. They're very rare. They're critically endangered, but they don't show up too often. And there's only a handful of specimens around the world that can be studied. But the study that came out this week is looking at a way of dating them or figuring out how old they are based on their scales. And previous studies have done similar things by shining light through the scales and looking for growth rings, like on a tree. Many fish have this sort of growth ring pattern that you can use to age them. It's quite subtle, but researchers can do it using this technique. But this is looking at a new way of using the sort of ring growth technique. And rather than using transmitted light, they're using polarized light. And it lets them see even more carefully and in detail these tiny rings on the scales. It turns out the original assumptions for the lifespan of these fish was about 20 years old. And with how big they get, up to 2 meters and 100 kilograms, the calculation basically says that they're one of the fastest growing fish out there in order to reach that size by that age. But this study actually flips things on its head and says that that's completely off and that actually their maximum lifespan is a century, not 20 years, but five times that, which would make them one of the slowest growing fish in the seas, right up there with one of the oldest living animal that we know of, the Greenland shark, which can live up to 400 years old or so. But the coelacanth, they've been found up to 100 years old. And what's interesting is that this sort of matches their ecology. The idea of a very slow growth lifestyle matches the fact that they have slow metabolism. They have really high capacity for low oxygen. So they can live at this sort of really low and almost anoxic waters deep in the sea. And they have live birth. So they nurture their, they gestate their eggs inside the body and then give birth live. And what the study found was looking at how long the gestation might last. And they discovered that it might actually last up to 5 years, which would make it the longest gestation period of any living animal, which is incredibly shocking to me. 5 year gestation period is very long, but that they might even actually reach sexual maturity in their middle years, around 40 to 50 years old, which is, I can't imagine having to go through puberty for more than however long it takes in humans, but imagine if you had to go through it for 50 years. I know. But all of this sort of brings to mind an ecological concern for these fish, because they are critically endangered and the environment is changing quite quickly. And our relationship with fishing and the oceans is changing, has changed very quickly over the last several decades. When animals have a very long generational period and a slow lifespan, it's hard for them to adapt quickly to these sorts of changes. So they're extremely vulnerable, I think, to these disturbances that we're causing in the environment. But cool things from the coelacanth world. I'm excited to hear what more comes out over the course of my life. Who knows? They're mystery, the fish of mysteries, the fisheries.
I suppose, yeah, it's kind of pleasing when such an old species is also quite slow moving in that regard. It's just plodding along for millions of years. It's kind of sweet.
Yeah, they're just doing their thing.
But that does bring us to the end of the news. Thank you, Nick. We will be back after this short break to talk about our theme, which this week is dinosaurs. Welcome back, listeners. This week's theme, as I mentioned, is on dinosaurs. So I thought I'd get us started with a quiz. You two up for that?
Love a quiz.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Okay, so a nice competition between the two. You've not faced off against each other yet, so there's a lot at stake, a lot of pride here.
I'm going to admit right off the bat that approaching this week's research, I took stock of my knowledge base here and realized I know nothing about dinosaurs. Out of spite, mind you, out of spite.
What I like about this competition is that they both pretend they're not competitive.
Definitely not competitive. Definitely not.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Neither of you. No, no, no. Neither of you wants to win this. It's fine. What is the biggest dinosaur ever found? And a bonus point for whoever gets the size closest.
30 meters.
I'm going to say smaller than that because that would make it bigger than a whale, I think. And I'm going to say
29 meters.
I'm going to say 22 meters. Oh, and I feel like it's somewhere in there in my brain what it is, but I can't think. I can't think of the... It's not a T-Rex, but it's like...
Titanosaurus.
Oh, maybe, yeah, that sounds right, but I can't think of... I'll have to make a different guess because I feel like it's unfair to steal your guess. Yeah, no, I can't think of anything.
Ah, fair enough. It wouldn't have made a difference. His guess was wrong. So... Nick does get the bonus point, though. The longest one, because it's a sauropod, they are actually longer than whales, but a lot of their body length is not mass, because they have those very long, thin tails and long, thin necks. So it's actually 40 meters long.
Whoa.
And for its name, what if I told you it was found in Argentina?
Argentinosaurus.
Yes, it is, yes. Okay, so here's a bit of an interesting question, because... I'll see what you guys answer. What was the first non-avian dinosaur found?
Megalosaurus?
Iguanodon.
Well, you can both get a point. This is quite an interesting thing. So Megalosaurus was described first, but it wasn't called a dinosaur. And the first one that was labeled a dinosaur, so in a way the first dinosaur found, was an iguanodon. That was where they got their name from. Interestingly, if you're going to go by the oldest dinosaur found, we're not entirely sure. So there was a chap called Robert Plott, and he worked for the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and he found a giant bone from a quarry in Cornwall. And he described it, but this is sort of in the 1600s. And he didn't really have a concept of extinction. So even when they found like very old fossilized shells, He hypothesized that it was crystallized frozen urine that just superficially resembled shells. Because the idea of animals being millions of years old that don't exist anymore was actually quite radical. We're so used to it now that we don't think of that as being unusual. But to find that, it wouldn't be on his mind that this is a now deceased animal. But they think it might have been something similar to the Megalosaurus. It was almost certainly like a theropod dinosaur. But they lost the fossil, so we don't know. We don't know what it was. How annoying is that?
They lost it.
I know, it must be quite big. But yeah, he did say that it, because he related it to, well, Goliath was a giant man, so maybe it was just a giant version of an animal we still have.
Little did he know it was a giant sparrow.
Yes. Okay. So, related to that, I will see if you get this right, because again, there's multiple answers for this. Where was this first dinosaur found? And I will accept the answer for either the Iguanodon or the Megalosaurus.
Dorset.
I was going to be like Britain, but is that too?
Naomi's throwing her net wide.
Yeah. I'm going to say Surrey.
Ooh, interesting. You've gone for where I'm from. You're both wrong.
We're both wrong. Okay, great.
Yeah. So the Iguanodon was found in London. If you were listening to the previous answer, you would have heard that there was a Megalosaurus found in Cornwall. I would have accepted that answer, but you weren't listening. It's fine. So it was actually Oxfordshire would be the most likely candidate for where the first dinosaur was found. Do you know who came up with the word dinosaur?
Richard Owen.
Yes, very good. He came up with the word dinosaur in describing the Iguanodon. Now, for the last one, I want to give you a chance to compete. So how much heavier, like times, was the largest dinosaur than the smallest, and the closest wins?
I want to be like 10,000 times, but I don't know if that's like too much. I'm just going to go for it.
1,500 times.
1,500 times. Okay. It was actually 20 million. So Naomi was closer there. But yeah, it's just to highlight the staggering range of dinosaurs that existed. They went from very small to very, very, very large. To give you an idea of that size difference, they were only on land. The weight difference between the smallest mammal and the largest mammal on land is only 3 million. So they were much more diverse than that sort of mammals are on land today. If you include blue whales, though, that does jump to 100 million. So.
Whoa. That's, yeah. My brain doesn't work that way, I guess. I can't imagine. I can't function. I can't process that.
Cool. Well, a good competition there, I feel. I think Naomi, you might have edged that one.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought Nick beat me to it, but...
In that case, maybe...
We'll call it a tie. But Nick, I believe you wanted to talk not about the first dinosaurs found, but sort of the first dinosaurs found.
Yeah, not in terms of, you know, human history, but in terms of dinosaurs being here on Earth. I want to talk about the earliest dinos. So, dinosaurs. Big group, super successful. Even after that, you know, pretty intense extinction, one group stuck around and are doing pretty well today. The birds are pretty successful. Everywhere you look, you can't help but hear them. But no, so the early dinosaurs were not like birds. Non-avian dinosaurs roamed the Earth for a nice 170 million years or so. And they were pretty much the dominant life form in the terrestrial large-bodied zone for that time period. And went extinct, like I said, about 66 million years ago. But when did they arise exactly? If they were around for 170 million years, we could do a little bit of math backwards and say, well, the earliest dinosaurs that we have direct evidence of that are indisputably dinosaurs is from around 230 million years ago. But these dinosaurs all appear in fossil assemblages that include many kinds of dinosaurs at once. It seems that already by that time, a dinosaur ecosystem had been established. So it's not really clear when the first dinosaur appeared. They didn't all appear all at once. There must have been some sort of gradual progression and diversification. But there's not a lot of evidence for it in the fossil record. It's pretty sparse in that time period. There's a period of about 15 million years between the most recent common ancestor of dinosaurs and their sister group that there isn't much evidence for. So that's sort of where people are looking to try to find early dinosaurs. But everything that shows up is in not such a great state, or it's pretty ambiguous. But these early dinosaurs that have appeared, that we do know for sure are dinosaurs, include such great names as Eoraptor, which means dawn raptor, and Herrerasaurus, which I am assuming, based on Argentinosaurus earlier, must be from Herrera, wherever that is. They're both bipedal, though, and that's something that distinguishes the early dinosaurs from their sister groups. That movement onto the two legs is sort of the hallmark of the dinosaur group, and it's something that helps researchers, or that researchers look for, to really make sure that a dinosaur is a dinosaur. And along with that shift to the two legs from four is a shift in the hips and the backbone. They basically convert their vertebrae. I think we've talked about this maybe briefly, but I want to go over this again because it gives us, I think that this is much clearer than maybe what I think I talked about this last time, to be honest. So this is a bit clearer, but reptiles, the rest of the reptile group, have two vertebrae fused together in the sacrum. But in order to be a dinosaur, a reptile has to have three fused together, at least. Modern birds have up to 12. So it's that fusion of the vertebrae into the sacrum that makes a dinosaur, the three and more. The only fossil so far that exists in that short period of 15 million years where they're looking for the earliest dinosaurs that might be a dinosaur is a fragment of a limb bone and some vertebrae that are close to the sacrum, but not the sacrum itself, from a 240 million year old partial fossil of an animal called Nyasasaurus parringtoni. Can you guys guess where the Nyasasaurus was found?
I feel really stupid. Is that a place?
What if I told you there's a lake in Tanzania called Lake Nyasa?
Oh.
I know. It's an obvious one once you get there, but no, that was sort of a blind one. But people are still on the hunt. So, you know, I've always given dinosaurs sort of short shrift as a mammal person and been thought of them sort of as the, you know, they're not the underdogs. They're definitely not the underdogs of the paleontology world. But it's pretty cool. There's a lot that isn't known about them still, and there's still things being discovered even now. So keep an eye out. You may find someday somewhere in a lake near you, 240 million plus year old dinosaur.
In a lake near me.
You never know. Well, actually, probably it would be a lake in Argentina or Brazil. So maybe not near you. But
no, that's quite far away from me, actually.
It is. But that's where most of the early dinosaurs have been found.
That's interesting. Now, I suppose we all think we have an idea of dinosaurs, and a lot of that comes from the media we consume. But Naomi, you're here to tell us that sometimes the media lies.
Yes, so this section is about velociraptors, or the alternative title is Lies from Jurassic Park. So I wanted to talk a little bit about velociraptors, and I think the most famous depiction of velociraptors is from Jurassic Park. But unfortunately, it's not really that accurate a description of Jurassic Park for a couple of reasons. One, our knowledge of dinosaurs, and particularly velociraptors and their relatives, has improved a lot. And two, I think it's something they actually even mention in the movie, that maybe the true depiction isn't really what people want to buy into either. So, you know, I think they maybe kept some of the inaccuracies in because it was more visually appealing. But first, the first one is, so velociraptors, as they're depicted in the movie, are maybe twice the actual size of what velociraptors would have been. Velociraptors are probably maybe the size of a turkey. And so it's probably more closely modeled on Deinonychus, which is a relative of Velociraptor, which is a little bit bigger, and it probably matches it a little bit better. But interestingly, actually, there has been another raptor since the movies came out. So there's been another much larger raptor that has been discovered, and it's called the Utah raptor. And it's quite large. It's about 6 meters long, and it weighed about 1,000 kilograms. So it would have been quite a scary raptor. And I think I definitely would have been frightened if that came into my kitchen. Another thing about velociraptors is probably something that you're probably familiar with now, but they would have been probably covered in feathers. They probably would have had kind of a full coat of kind of downy feathers, and they would have had feathers on their arms as well. Another interesting one that they sort of touch on in the movie is they do this kind of toe tapping thing, which is quite scary, but scientists now think that they actually probably just would have walked with that one terrible claw upwards, and they wouldn't have used it to tap on the ground. Their kind of footprints and things just suggest that they just walked with 2 feet on the ground and their claw would have been upright. Another thing is their claw probably didn't disembowel. It was probably good for injuring, but it didn't specifically disembowel. And they potentially weren't pack hunters either. There have been some finds where they do find velociraptors in groups, but it's generally suggested that it's a little bit more circumstantial, that maybe it was not quite this pack hunting, but more sort of a different kind of predatory behavior, maybe like mobbing or kind of scavenging perhaps instead. One other cool fossil I'd like to mention just before I wrap up. There's a really cool fossil that's been found. I think it was found in Mongolia. And it shows a velociraptor that's locked in combat with their protoceratops, which is a really impressive fossil. Definitely worth looking up. And so the way they were kind of, it really shows a really cool snapshot in time, this particular fossil. My final fact about velociraptors is they would have been quite fast, but maybe about 40 kilometers per hour, but in short bursts. So they could have maybe outrun humans, but maybe only in short rapid bursts. And again, they maybe wouldn't have been very super intelligent either. They would have been relatively smart, but kind of more along the lines of a bird of prey, as opposed to say something like a parrot or crow or even kind of a mammal.
I will say that, okay, maybe the size of a turkey is smaller than the raptors that we've seen in the movies, but turkeys are quite scary and bigger than you think.
That is true, yeah, and particularly with those calls are quite vicious. Okay, on the velociraptor.
My main question for this is, I've always been fascinated by this, that, yeah, they called them velociraptors, but they're basically a Deinonychus. Why didn't they just call them Deinonychus?
So interestingly, something that I heard, which I think it's kind of anecdotal and I wasn't able to find support for it, but basically I think when the book was written, Jurassic Park, the book, velociraptors and Deinonychus were thought to be subspecies of the same animal. So I think when he wrote the book, I think he called it velociraptor, but they were thought to be kind of similar or subspecies. And then I guess for the movie, I don't know, I guess maybe because it was based on the book and it was velociraptors in the book, I'm not sure. But like I said, I wasn't able to verify that, and that's just kind of anecdotal.
I suppose, yeah, this sort of inspired me on my topic a bit, in the sense that because of media, we have this assumption that dinosaurs are massive. And in museums as well, you want really cool fossils to bring people in, so you put these massive fossils in there. But not all dinosaurs are massive. You can't just have an entire ecosystem of enormous animals. It'd be like if everything was elephant size. It doesn't really make sense. They sort of have to be on a scale. And as I mentioned before, the lightest dinosaur was 20 million times lighter than the heaviest. So there's huge, broad range in size of dinosaurs. But I think if I were to ask you two, were you two dinosaur children?
Not really, no.
No.
No, oh. So did you ever have a favorite dinosaur growing up?
No, I didn't.
I think that I liked the pterodactyl, which isn't a dinosaur, but from the little, what is the movie called? The little...
Land Before Time?
The Land Before Time. Thanks. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I liked the pterodactyl in that one.
I was always quite a fan of Triceratops as well. I've never lived in England, though. But I think you'd be hard-pushed to find someone whose favourite dinosaur was small. I think, yeah, the appeal when you see them is that they were so much bigger than everything we might... Like a pterosaur... You wouldn't pick the smallest one. You'd pick the one that's like bigger than all the birds you see, because that would be so cool seeing it in the sky and things. And that's the thing why it grabs the imagination. But there were a large number of small dinosaurs, including not one. So there's been a recent study. I don't know if you saw this. They said they'd found the smallest. It was either a bird or it was avian dinosaur, at least. It was about 100 million years old. And it would have been the smallest of those of dinosaurs at the time. That they found its head encased in amber. So they had this very, very small skull. And it was said to be like the smallest dinosaur ever found. But recently there's been papers reanalyzing that. And they think it may not have even been a dinosaur. And this highlights the problems you suggest, Nick, with the fused vertebrae. If you don't have a complete skeleton, it can be quite difficult. But what they actually think, looking at it, is that it was probably a lizard. They think it might have just been a really weird lizard, but so weird that they confused it with a bird.
Whoa.
Like, that's a pretty weird looking lizard, but it had a very narrow beak-like snout. But yeah, mainly they were looking at the teeth and the how the teeth were fused to the jaw, which is a trait seen just in lizards and snakes. But they think there's a possibility. It may not have even been one of them. It could have been something older and weirder, which is a bit sad. Do you guys know the smallest living dinosaur?
It's a hummingbird.
It is.
The bumblebee hummingbird.
Very good.
I was going to say that too, and I wasn't sure if I was just mixing it up with a bumblebee bat, or do we just like to call small things bumblebee something?
Which is weird, because bumblebees are quite big bees.
Yeah, right?
Naomi, do you want a chance to demonstrate? Do you know where it's found?
Oh, no.
It's in Cuba. Hmm. So I had a look for some smaller ones. One of the most interesting ones I found is they found the smallest sauropod. So things like Diplodocus, the Argentinosaurus sauropods, they're often in the entrance to museums, or at least were in the Natural History Museum, but they're big old things. And the smallest one they found, I don't know why I found this such a bizarre image in my head, but it was the size of an ox.
That's the smallest.
Yeah.
I would like that.
I just find that the most bizarre image in my head of like this really long-necked, long-tailed thing that's just as big as an ox.
I like it a lot. I want it.
I was really hoping it was going to be like teeny tiny and like so small and cute, but I suppose compared to some of the really big ones, an ox is still relatively small. I think their whole thing is they're big, right? Sauropods are...
But the good news for you, Naomi, is they would have had children, and their children would have been the smallest sauropods, and they would have been adorable.
That is true. I did think about that.
But there's also been other examples, like the Microraptor was often looked at, which is, yeah, on the way to birds sort of thing, like raptors we still have. But yeah, it was covered in feathers, and that was pretty small and pretty light, they estimate. But the smallest one that I think is still confirmed is the Parvicursor, which is a genus of dinosaurs with very long, slender legs for fast running. And they're only about 39 centimetres long. I love that. Only about 39 centimetres, it says. And it's probably only about 160 grams. So very, very small indeed.
That's cute. That's like one portion of pasta.
Yeah, so it's slightly bigger than a standard ruler and about the size of Nick's dinner.
Well, the first course.
So, Naomi, you sort of went for one misconception that might be common. I've gone for another one that, you know, the small dinosaurs definitely do exist and they're worth thinking about. And, Nick, I believe you've got a third.
Yeah. And, well, yes, I want to talk about dinosaur sounds, but I want to start with the dinosaurs we know best, the avian dinosaur, and how they got to be where they are now with all the sounds that they make at all hours of the day. So modern birds, from all of their crazy noises they make, birdsong and honks and whistles and, you know, toots and bleeps and blops, you know, all the things that birds do. They make all those sounds using a vocal organ that's unique to the avian dinosaur clade called the syrinx. And it's sort of analogous to the larynx in us that lets us do podcasts and, you know, opera. But it's located closer to the heart than it is in mammals. It's near the sort of junction of the trachea and the lungs. And there's vocal folds or membranes that attach to these rings of the syrinx and vibrate, similar to the way that our vocal cords vibrate. But it lets them do this crazy singing. And I think actually just a couple of weeks ago, a research study came out looking at how every muscle in the syrinx is innervated by an individual nerve, unlike the larynx in us. So it allows them the super fine control so they can do these crazy songs. That's how birds do their stuff. But it seems that the elements of this anatomical feature, the syrinx, didn't really enter the fossil record or haven't been preserved well in the fossil record for most of its history. They sort of they appear relatively recently in the Pleistocene and even the Holocene. There is not many reported fossils of this part of the body. Because it's cartilaginous, it's not bone, so it doesn't preserve as easily. The oldest known syrinx that's older than that was an Eocene specimen, so 25 million years or so ago, that wasn't described or illustrated, and the specimen seems to have sort of been forgotten, not really taken care of. But in 2016, a research study described the first found remains of a fossil syrinx from the Mesozoic. So that's the era of the dinosaurs, pre-66 million years ago, that was preserved in the late Cretaceous, around just the end of that period, so 66 to 69 million years ago, in Antarctica. And it's definitely from a bird, not from a non-avian dinosaur. But it was it seems like it was sort of an in-between syrinx. It wasn't a complex syrinx, but it was something that came later in the evolution of birds. The other things that sort of make birds birds, like the way they breathe and flying, came much earlier than this sort of way of communicating that birds have and use so much today. And in fact, many researchers now are starting to realize and to argue that the ability that birds have to do this complex vocalization is part of what's allowed them to diversify so wildly. But that's, like I said, it arose in the bird lineage, not the non-avian dinosaur lineage. So what did dinosaurs sound like if they didn't honk, sing, tweedle, torp, bloop, or bleep? And we look back at this, what they had anatomically. That's sort of the only way that we can look at it. And most of the preserved dinosaur specimens we have are the hard parts, the bones and other things. So that's sort of what we have to go off of. And it's not a lot. It seems that there was, neither was there a syrinx nor a larynx, which is the other archosaur branch that exists today in crocodiles. They have a larynx, like in mammals. It's not exactly the same, but it's much more similar than the birds. And, you know, crocodiles, they can do a bit of a roar. They can do a bit of like, you know, this not really articulate sound, but sorry, nothing, you know, no foul to the crocodiles there. But it seems that dinosaurs didn't have this. So if they did anything at all, it's likely they just did things like hissing, like many other lizards and turtles that exist today in a similar lineage that don't have larynxes. That said, even though hissing seems to be the most parsimonious explanation for dinosaur sounds, some dinosaurs have some unusual skull adaptations. In particular, there's a couple of lineages that have these resonant chambers in the nasal and skull, in the nasal area of the skull, that may have been used to amplify their maybe vocalizations or hissing that they could do that would resonate in a way that would be much louder, kind of like a drum inside their head. All of this said, though, again, it leaves me at least wanting to know more. And I would love to have a time machine so I could go back and, you know, hear the sounds of the Mesozoic. Apparently, by this time, insects had already developed the ability to stridulate. So you'd get crickets and, you know, other sort of ancient crickets making sounds in the Triassic twilight. Maybe not a dinosaur roar. I think your T-Rex would come after you with a hiss, not a bang.
So yeah, that would even be creepier if it was just silent.
Like most predators when they're hunting, to be honest. You don't want to be heard.
That's true. But one thing we do want to hear is Naomi, because I believe you're going to close us out with what I suppose is the true end of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, what would be a good topic to bring up about dinosaurs and the death of all dinosaurs. So I wanted to talk about the extinction that brought about the end of dinosaurs. So 66 million years ago, a asteroid that was about 6 miles across struck what is now the Yucatan Peninsula, and that triggered the fifth mass extinction in world's history. So with this, it's brought up a lot of debris, and the air basically would have turned into an oven. There would have been huge forest fires that would have landed all over the world. There would have been a really heat pulse that would have caused like an impact winter, and the sky would have been blotted out by soot and ash as the temperatures then fell. So at this point, yeah, sorry, I made it sound very grim. At this point, 75% of species that were known at the end of the Cretaceous period died. So they didn't make it to the next period, the Paleogene. And, you know, I think this one is very famous because this is when the dinosaurs died. Except, as we've discussed in several times in this episode and others, not all the dinosaurs died. Because, in fact, we know that birds are dinosaurs or avian dinosaurs. So I was kind of fan this piece of research, or this article that was looking at kind of why some of the theories as to maybe why birds were some of the lucky ones to survive this extinction. And birds had been around, you know, the earliest bird fossils were found kind of about 150 million years ago, the first bird-like animals were found. And one thing that all the modern birds have, they are all beaked birds. But this wasn't always the case. A lot of early birds had teeth and jaws. And something that this piece of work was looking at was suggesting that maybe beaks might be something that helped push birds over this edge and kind of push them towards being able to survive this mass extinction. So the reason for this that they're kind of looking at, and so I talked about it before in the last episode with birds and their skeletons on flight, and beaks are very useful because they're light and they can kind of get reduce some of the bone in the jaw and the mouth and teeth. But they think that maybe actually beak may have come about because it allowed a different type of food to be eaten. So it allowed birds to tap into this type of food a bit that was a bit more herbivorous. So they could be eaten seeds and nuts and kind of more plant-based things that other animals or other birds and dinosaurs couldn't have eaten. And additionally as well, because actually the birds that had teeth also didn't survive this mass extinction as well. And so this may have kind of been one of the things that gave the birds this extra little bit of luck or this extra trait that helped them survive. Although, however, there are some other birds that did have beaks. There was a duck-like bird that had a beak and yet it still died. So perhaps a little bit more than just the beak. There's also this combination that maybe a powerful gizzard was quite useful as well, because again, allowing them to consume this sort of tough seeds and this tough sort of vegetation that allowed them to kind of take over this niche or this food source that was kind of a little bit untapped. So yeah, that was kind of some of the things that I found that may, perhaps the reason that birds survived when other types of birds and non-avian dinosaurs didn't survive is because birds have beaks. Of course, you know, as I mentioned, this is kind of just a theory, and also there's, you know, potentially a lot of other traits that contributed to this and, you know, could have just been luck at the same time too. But yeah, I thought I would end with the dinosaur ending event.
But that does bring us to an end. I hope you've enjoyed this week. I certainly have learned some amazing things about dinosaurs. We will be back next week though, so don't fret. And our new topic will be food webs, which isn't just about spiders. It's sort of about how ecosystems interact. So please join us again next week. But for now, from everyone here at the Natural Selection Presents, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
I was going to just be silent and be like, I'm a dinosaur, but I didn't think that would translate to an audio format.
If there's a listener out there that in that brief pause thought Naomi's doing a dinosaur impression, write in, because you guys should be best friends. Like.